From Intellijix, this is Intellijix True Crime. Today, three true cases, each one investigated, tried, and closed. Let's begin. The paramedics who responded to the call on that October morning in 2009 found Glenn Hamilton on the floor of his home in Orange County, California, barely conscious, his body in the grip of something none of them could immediately name. He was 53 years old. He had been sick, his wife Cynthia told them, sick for days, really, the kind of sick that comes on slow and then all at once. They loaded him into the ambulance and rushed him to the hospital, and Cynthia Hamilton followed behind, a licensed vocational nurse who understood, perhaps better than most, exactly what was happening to her husband's body. Glenn Hamilton would be dead within days. And the thing that killed him, colorless, odorless, faintly sweet, had been placed there, prosecutors would later argue, by the very person who had stood at his bedside and watched him go. Glenn Hamilton was the kind of man people describe when they're trying to explain what they mean by steady. He had spent years building a life in Orange County that was quiet in the way that good lives often are, unremarkable from the outside, deeply felt from within. Friends remembered him as generous, quick with a laugh, the sort of person who remembered your birthday and meant it when he asked how you were doing. He worked, he came home, he loved his family. He and Cynthia had been married for years, a union that, like most long marriages, had accumulated its share of weather. But Glenn, by all accounts, was committed to it. He trusted the person he had built that life with. That trust, the evidence would eventually show, was precisely what was used against him. The illness seemed to come from nowhere. In the days before that October morning, Glenn had complained of nausea, weakness, a general wrongness he couldn't quite articulate. He'd been drinking fluids, trying to stay hydrated. He'd leaned on Cynthia, who brought him things, who tended to him with the practiced efficiency of someone who had spent a career in medicine. When his condition worsened dramatically, when the confusion set in, when his kidneys began to shut down, the paramedics were called, and Glenn was admitted to the hospital in acute distress. His organs were failing. The doctors worked to stabilize him, ran their tests, tried to find the source. Glenn Hamilton died on October 7, 2009. In the immediate aftermath, the death was treated as suspicious enough to warrant a full toxicological examination. This was not, investigators would later say, because anything obvious pointed to foul play at first. It was procedure. Glenn had been a relatively healthy man of middle age with no documented history of the kind of catastrophic organ failure that had taken his life so suddenly. The medical examiner ordered a comprehensive screen, and what came back changed the nature of everything that followed. Ethylene glycol, the primary ingredient in antifreeze. It was present in Glenn Hamilton's system in quantities that the medical examiner concluded were lethal, not a trace amount, not the kind of incidental exposure that might come from environmental contamination, but a dose consistent, the pathologist determined, with deliberate ingestion over time. Ethylene glycol poisoning has a particular cruelty to it. It doesn't announce itself. In its early stages, it mimics intoxication, disorientation, nausea, a kind of dazed stumbling. By the time the body reveals what's really happening, the kidneys are already under siege. The crystals that ethylene glycol produces as it metabolizes accumulate in the renal tubules, and the damage compounds with every passing hour. A person poisoned slowly, in increments, might not realize what was wrong until it was far too late to reverse. Glenn Hamilton, the toxicology now confirmed, had been that person. The Orange County Sheriff's Department opened a homicide investigation. What investigators found when they began pulling on the threads of Glenn and Cynthia Hamilton's life together was a financial picture that, in their assessment, told its own kind of story. In the months before Glenn's death, Cynthia Hamilton had increased the life insurance policy on her husband, substantially, according to court records. The timing was notable. The increase had been made not years earlier in some routine review of the couple's finances, but relatively recently, close enough to Glenn's death that prosecutors would make it a centerpiece of the case they were building. Shortly after Glenn died, Cynthia moved to collect on that policy. The claim, investigators noted, was filed with what they characterized as urgency. Cynthia Hamilton was a licensed vocational nurse. She had medical training. She understood the pharmacological world in a way that most people do not. Understood how substances move through the body. Understood what monitoring looks like and what it misses. Understood, perhaps, that a man suffering from what appeared to be a sudden illness might not immediately prompt a search for poison. These were not facts that prosecutors invented. They were credentials. But in the context of what the toxicology had revealed, they carried weight. There is always a moment in an investigation like this when the abstract becomes concrete, when the question shifts from how did this happen to who did this. For the detectives working Glenn Hamilton's case, the evidence was assembling itself into a coherent and deeply troubling shape. The ethylene glycol, the insurance, the nursing background, the timeline. Search records and financial documents obtained through warrants were examined carefully. Investigators looked at the household, at what had been purchased, at what could have been acquired without drawing attention. Antifreeze, after all, is not a controlled substance. It sits on shelves at hardware stores and auto part shops across the country. Its sweetness, toxicologists noted in court testimony, makes it possible to mix into beverages without immediate detection. Cynthia Hamilton was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. She maintained her innocence. Her defense, as it took shape heading into trial, would challenge the prosecution's interpretation of the evidence, would argue, as defense attorneys in such cases often must, that the picture prosecutors painted was a theory, not a certainty. Glenn had been sick. People die of sudden illness. The insurance policy was a financial decision, not a premeditated one. These were the arguments that would be tested in court. The trial began in 2011 in Orange County. What the prosecution laid out for the jury was, at its core, a case built on three interlocking pillars: the toxicology, the finances, and the defendant's expertise. The medical examiner testified in detail about the presence of ethylene glycol in Glenn Hamilton's system and about the mechanism of death, renal failure precipitated by the accumulation of oxalate crystals, a process consistent with repeated ingestion of antifreeze over days. This was not, the expert testified, consistent with accidental poisoning. The quantity involved and the manner of its apparent administration pointed towards something deliberate. Financial records were introduced showing the increase in Glenn's life insurance coverage in the period before his death and showing the subsequent claim filed by Cynthia. Prosecutors argued to the jury that the motive was money, that Glenn Hamilton's life had been worth more to his wife dead than alive, and that she had acted on that calculation with cold precision. The prosecution further argued that Cynthia's professional training gave her both the knowledge to select a method that mimicked illness and the composure to manage the aftermath. To present herself as a grieving wife while her husband lay dying of something she had allegedly placed in his drinks. There was testimony about Cynthia's demeanor, about financial pressures the couple had been navigating, about the timeline of events in those final weeks of Glenn's life. Witnesses placed Cynthia in the role of primary caretaker during Glenn's illness, the person who prepared his food, who brought him his drinks, who managed the household environment in which he was deteriorating. Prosecutors pointed to this not as an act of devotion, but as an act of control, as the structural fact that made the alleged poisoning possible. The defense challenged what it could. It questioned the interpretation of the financial evidence, suggested that insurance adjustments are routine matters rather than evidence of murderous intent, and worked to humanize Cynthia Hamilton as a woman who had loved her husband and lost him to illness. But the toxicology was difficult to argue around. Ethylene glycol does not appear in a person's body by accident in lethal concentrations. The defense could not offer an alternative explanation that accounted for the evidence in a way the jury found persuasive. After deliberation, the jury returned a verdict of guilty on the charge of first-degree murder. Cynthia Hamilton was sentenced to 25 years to life in California State Prison. She was, at sentencing, a middle-aged woman who had spent her career in medicine, who had, by the nature of her work, been trusted with the care of vulnerable people. The judge, in imposing sentence, did not need to editorialize. The jury had already rendered its verdict on what she had done with that trust. The appeal came, as it almost always does. Cynthia Hamilton's attorneys raised legal challenges to the conviction, arguing, as appellate counsel must, that errors at trial had denied her a fair proceeding. The California Appellate Court reviewed the record. The conviction was upheld. The legal challenges did not find purchase in the appellate record, and the court affirmed both the verdict and the sentence. As of the available court records, Cynthia Hamilton remains incarcerated, serving her sentence. What lingers in cases like this one is not the evidence, as compelling as it is. It's the intimacy of it. The forensic facts of the Hamilton case are, in their own clinical way, clear enough. A man was poisoned with a substance that was mixed, prosecutors argued and the jury found, into his drinks by someone he trusted completely, someone he would not have thought to question when she handed him a glass. That is the particular horror that this kind of case carries. Not the violence of it, because there is no visible violence here, but the betrayal of it. The daily fabric of a marriage, the 10,000 ordinary moments of a shared life, were the mechanism through which Glenn Hamilton's death was allegedly administered. Every glass he was handed, every act of apparent care. The jury found that these were not acts of love, but of calculated harm. Glenn Hamilton deserved better than what the jury found was done to him. He deserved the chance to grow older, to see what his life would become, to be sick sometimes and be cared for genuinely. He was a steady man, a man who trusted. The California justice system, imperfect, as all human systems are, eventually answered for what was done to him, though no verdict restores what was taken. There are, in the files of county medical examiners and sheriff's departments across this country, cases that were never made. Cases where the toxicology wasn't ordered, where the insurance wasn't noticed, where the grieving spouse collected and moved on, and the truth stayed buried with the victim. Glenn Hamilton's case became a prosecuted case, a convicted case, an upheld case, because enough people paid enough attention at enough of the right moments. A medical examiner who ordered the right tests, investigators who looked at the financial records, a jury that weighed the evidence carefully and returned a verdict they believed the facts demanded. That is not a small thing. In the long accounting of what justice requires, it matters that someone looked. It matters that Glenn Hamilton's death did not pass unremarked into the official category of sudden illness, another quiet exit from a life that people would eventually stop talking about. Someone looked, and then someone else looked, and then 12 citizens of Orange County sat in a courtroom and concluded, beyond a reasonable doubt, what had happened to him. The antifreeze is on the shelf at every hardware store. The sweetness of it, toxicologists will tell you, is almost pleasant. It dissolves easily. It leaves no color, no odor, nothing to betray its presence in a glass of liquid handed by one person to another. It is, in the grim taxonomy of poisons, an accessible thing. What it requires is not chemistry or sophistication or even particular planning. What it requires, the evidence in this case suggested, is proximity. The proximity of a life shared, of a home where someone moves freely, of a marriage where trust has been extended so completely that it no longer requires examination. That proximity was everything the prosecution argued that Cynthia Hamilton had and used. Glenn Hamilton went to the hospital on an October morning in 2009, his body failing him in ways he had no reason to understand. He died 4 days later. The woman who stood by his bedside and watched him go was, the jury found, the reason he was there. She is serving 25 years to life. He is not coming back. That asymmetry, the sentence on one side, the permanence on the other, is the thing that true crime can never fully resolve, no matter how carefully the story is told. The law did what the law can do. It named what happened. It assigned a consequence. What it cannot do, what nothing can do, is give Glenn Hamilton back his life, his future, the ordinary, unremarkable days that were taken from him one glass at a time. So we tell the story. We say his name. We make sure that whatever else is recorded about those events in Orange County in the fall of 2009, the record includes this. Glenn Hamilton was a good man who trusted someone he shouldn't have, and he deserved better than what the evidence showed he got. Our next case takes us to Lincoln County, Oregon. The call came in on the morning of December 19th, 2001. A man walking the rocky shoreline near Lintslow, just off the Oregon coast south of Newport, noticed something in the water that didn't belong there. It was a suitcase, half submerged and snagged against the rocks, and inside it were the remains of a small child. Within days, two more children would be found nearby. Their small bodies weighted and concealed inside pieces of luggage that had been thrown into the frigid waters of Yakina Bay. A fourth body, that of their mother, washed ashore on the beach at Mulak, a few miles to the north. A family had vanished from the earth, quietly, over the course of a single December week, and the man who should have been searching for them was already gone, sunburned and smiling in the warmth of a Mexican resort town, telling people his name was Michael Finkel of the New York Times. Mary Jane Longo was 34 years old when she died. People who knew her described a woman of remarkable patience and gentle warmth, someone who had poured herself into the work of raising her three children with a devotion that, by all accounts, was the defining feature of her life. She had grown up in a Jehovah's Witness household in Michigan, a faith that shaped her values deeply: community, family, integrity, the importance of keeping one's word. She met Christian Longo in church circles when they were young, and she loved him with a steadiness that those around her would later describe as both her greatest gift and, in the end, her most consequential vulnerability. Together they had three children: Zachary, who was 4 years old, Sadie, who was three, and Madison, who was just two. By all documented accounts, Mary Jane was a devoted, hands-on mother. She homeschooled the children, filled their days with structure and love, and by the testimony of family and friends, found in her role as a mother something close to a calling. She was, those who knew her would say, exactly the kind of person who does not end up in a news story like this one. Christian Longo, by contrast, had been living a kind of parallel life for years. A performance, really, staged for an audience that had no idea it was watching theater. Court records and extensive reporting would later document a man who had been running financial fraud schemes since at least the late 1990s, forging checks, stealing from employers, running up debts he had no intention of paying, and moving his family from city to city whenever the walls began to close in. He had a gift for presentation, for making himself appear prosperous and trustworthy, and he wielded that gift with practiced ease. He drove nice cars, cars that weren't paid for. He dressed well in clothes that were, in some cases, simply stolen. He told his wife, his family, his church community, a succession of employers, that things were fine, that things were always fine. The Longos had lived in Michigan, in Ohio, and by 2001 had landed in Waldport, Oregon, a small coastal town in Lincoln County, where the Pacific wind comes off the water cold and the community is tight-knit and quiet. Christian was working odd jobs. The finances were, as usual, a disaster hidden behind a pleasant face, and the family was living in a rental home that, prosecutors would later allege, was rented under false pretenses. The last confirmed sightings of the family together came in mid-December 2001. Neighbors and acquaintances placed the Longos at their Waldport home in the days before Christmas. What happened inside that home during those final days, the precise sequence, the specific moments, emerged from the evidence and from Longo's own shifting, contradictory accounts, which he gave at various points in ways that prosecutors and the jury would ultimately find not credible. What the physical evidence documented was this: Mary Jane Longo and her daughter Madison were strangled. Zachary and Sadie were found in the luggage in Yakina Bay, and the manner of their deaths was consistent with drowning. The children had been placed inside pieces of the family's own luggage, a red suitcase, a duffel bag, which were then thrown from a bridge into the cold bay water below. Mary Jane's body, when recovered, showed signs that she too had been placed in or near the water, though she had drifted separately along the coast. The discovery unfolded in stages, each one worse than the last. The first child was found on December 19th near Lintslow. Investigators from the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office responded and quickly identified the grim nature of what had been found. Over the following days, more remains were recovered from the bay and the surrounding shoreline. By the time the fourth body was identified, investigators knew they were looking at the deaths of an entire family. What they did not yet know was where Christian Longo was, or whether he too might be a victim somewhere, undiscovered. He was not a victim. He was in Cancun. Longo had left Oregon shortly after the deaths. The exact date was established through subsequent investigation and made his way south across the border into Mexico. And he had done something that, when it became public, struck many people as almost incomprehensible in its audacity. He had assumed the identity of Michael Finkel, a journalist who had recently been a staff writer for the New York Times. He had chosen Finkel specifically, prosecutors would later document, having been familiar with Finkel's byline. In Cancun, Longo socialized at bars and on beaches, told people he was a journalist, cultivated acquaintances, and even began what witnesses described as a romantic relationship with a woman he met there. He was tan and relaxed. His family had been dead for weeks. The break in the case came through a combination of investigative work and an unlikely piece of international reporting. While Lincoln County investigators were working to identify and locate Christian Longo, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal named Jose de Cordoba was working on a story about American expatriates in the Yucatan. Through a source in Cancun's social scene, he encountered a man who called himself Michael Finkel, and something didn't quite sit right. De Cordoba did enough checking to realize the man's story had holes, and he alerted authorities. That tip, combined with ongoing coordination between Oregon investigators and the FBI, led to Longo's arrest in Cancun on January 13, 2002, approximately 1 month after his family's bodies began washing ashore. He was extradited to Oregon, and the investigation that followed was extensive and methodical. Prosecutors built their case around physical evidence recovered from the Waldport home, from the bay, and from Longo's movements in the days surrounding the deaths. The luggage in which the children were found was identified as belonging to the Longo family. Evidence of the family's financial situation, the mounting fraud, the bad checks, the debts, was documented at length, and prosecutors argued it established the context in which the killings occurred, suggesting Longo had been facing the imminent collapse of his fabricated life and had chosen the most devastating possible exit. They argued he killed his family rather than face what was coming. Longo, for his part, made the unusual and legally risky decision to represent himself at trial, though he had standby counsel. He took the stand in his own defense, itself a rare choice, and offered an account that placed partial responsibility for some of the deaths on Mary Jane herself, a claim prosecutors forcefully contested and that the jury would ultimately reject. His testimony was by turns detailed and evasive, and observers who covered the trial noted that he displayed the same surface-level composure and apparent ease that had characterized his years of fraud. He seemed, reporters observed, almost unconcerned. The trial took place in Lincoln County in 2003. Prosecutors presented a methodical case built on forensic evidence, witness testimony about Longo's behavior and movements, and the documented history of his fraud and deception. They argued that each of the four deaths was an intentional killing committed by Christian Longo, and that the circumstances, the concealment of the children's bodies, the flight to Mexico, the assumed identity, reflected consciousness of guilt. The jury agreed. On April 16, 2003, Christian Longo was convicted on four counts of aggravated murder. Shortly thereafter, in the penalty phase, the same jury sentenced him to death. The conviction did not end the legal proceedings because capital cases in Oregon, as in most states, carry with them a long appellate trail that can stretch across decades. Longo pursued multiple avenues of appeal over the years that followed. The Oregon Supreme Court reviewed the case and upheld the conviction and the death sentence. Federal habeas corpus proceedings followed, as they routinely do in capital cases, and those two ultimately did not result in relief for Longo. As of the most recent available public record, Christian Longo remains on Oregon's death row. Oregon has had a de facto moratorium on executions for an extended period, meaning that while the sentence stands, it has not been carried out. There is one more chapter to this story that became, in its own strange way, part of the public record. While awaiting trial, Longo struck up a correspondence with the real Michael Finkel, the journalist whose identity he had stolen. It was a surreal arrangement. The man who had borrowed another man's name reached out to that man, and Finkel, a journalist who had recently been let go from the Times over a fabricated detail in an unrelated story, agreed to communicate with him. The two exchanged letters and had phone conversations over a period of months. Finkel ultimately wrote a book about the experience, published in 2005, entitled True Story, Murder, Memoir, Mea Culpa, which later became the basis for a 2015 film. In his book, Finkel grappled honestly with the discomfort of his own fascination with Longo, with what it meant to be drawn into a conversation with a man convicted of killing four people, including three children who could not yet tie their own shoes. It is an uncomfortable thing to sit with, that fascination, but Finkel at least had the decency to examine it rather than simply indulge it. What tends to get lost in the true crime machinery, in the details of extraditions and aliased identities and courtroom strategy, is the plainness of what was taken. Zachary Longo was 4, Sadie was 3, Madison had only just turned 2. Mary Jane was a woman in her mid-30s who had built her entire life around the love and care of those three small people. Whatever the financial pressures, whatever the unraveling that preceded those December days, whatever account Christian Longo offered from the witness stand, none of it reaches anywhere near the weight of those four lives, ended before most of them had really begun. Lincoln County, Oregon, is the kind of place where the ocean is always present, where you can hear the water from almost anywhere, where the coast shapes the rhythms of daily life. The bay at Yakina has a cold beauty to it, the kind that asks nothing of you and offers nothing back. In the winter, when the light goes flat and the wind comes in off the Pacific, it is a place that can feel very far from anywhere. It was there, in that cold water, that Zachary and Sadie were found. It was on that shoreline that their mother was recovered. The Longo case has been analyzed and written about and filmed, and in all of that documentation, the court records, the journalism, the book, the movie, there is a danger that the story becomes about the man who ran, who lied, who wore another person's name, like a costume, on a sunny Mexican beach. He is, it must be said, a compelling villain in the technical sense. The audacity of the identity theft, the composure, the courtroom performance, these things pull the eye. But the story is Mary Jane's. It is Zachary's and Sadie's and Madison's. They are the ones who deserved a different December. They are the ones who should have had a Christmas that year and a new year and the years after that, years of school and scraped knees and growing up along the Oregon coast with the sound of the ocean in the background and a mother who loved them with everything she had. She did love them. That much, at least, is beyond dispute. The people who knew Mary Jane Longo said so. Every one of them, and nothing that came after, nothing in any courtroom or any book, ever suggested otherwise. She loved them, and she deserved so much better than what she got. Our next case takes us to Nashville, Tennessee. The phone rang at the Davidson County Sheriff's Dispatch Center on the night of April 23, 1997, and the voice on the other end was quiet, almost confused. A teenager who had walked into the McDonald's on Nolensville Road and found something that made no sense to him. The lights were on, the fryers were still running, the radio was playing, but no one came to the counter. No one answered when he called out. He walked a little further in, and then he stopped, and then he called 911. What officers found when they arrived would mark the beginning of one of the most disturbing chapters in Nashville's modern history. A story that would consume the city's attention for years, haunt the families of 7 young people, and eventually lead investigators through a trail of surveillance tape, fingerprints, and sheer methodical persistence to a man whose capacity for violence, it turned out, had been well documented long before anyone in Tennessee knew his name. Let's go back a little further. Let's talk about who these people were before we talk about what happened to them. Ronald Santiago was 23 years old and working at the McDonald's on Nolensville Road. His family remembered him as steady, reliable, the kind of young man who showed up early and stayed late. Jose Gonzalez was 16, still in high school, picking up shifts to help his family. They were found that April night alongside a third victim, a young woman named Lorraine Hendricks, who was 23 and had been, by all accounts, cheerful and well-liked by her co-workers. At a Captain D's restaurant on Clarksville Pike, just weeks before, on the night of February 16, 1997, two more young people had been found, Sarah Jackson and Andrea Brown, both in their early 20s. And then in March, at a Baskin-Robbins and McDonald's on Old Hickory Boulevard, two more names would be added to a list that Nashville could not believe it was keeping, Michelle Mace and Robert Sewell. Seven people in all. Seven people who had gone to work at fast food restaurants, the kind of places so ordinary, so woven into everyday life that you pass them without thinking, and who never came home. They were students and siblings and children, and in every meaningful sense, people at the very beginning of their lives. That is who they were. That is who this story is about. The pattern emerged with terrible clarity in the weeks following the Nolensville Road McDonald's murders. Metro Nashville Police and the FBI, working together with an urgency that the sheer scale of the crimes demanded, began piecing together what had happened across those three separate crime scenes in a span of roughly 10 weeks. The working theory that investigators developed, and which prosecutors would later argue at trial, was consistent across all three locations. According to court records and trial testimony, a man had entered each restaurant near or after closing time when employees were at their most vulnerable, the registers being counted, the mop buckets out, the parking lot going quiet. He had taken control of the employees, and he had taken the cash. And then, in each case, he had left no survivors. The robberies themselves, prosecutors argued, were almost secondary. The killing was methodical. Investigators noted, and would later present to juries, that the manner in which the victims had been restrained and positioned suggested a practiced, deliberate approach. Not the panicked violence of someone surprised, but something more controlled, and therefore more chilling. Metro Nashville detectives worked the cases simultaneously, cross-referencing every detail. They canvassed the neighborhoods. They reviewed every frame of available surveillance footage from the restaurants and from nearby businesses. They collected physical evidence at each scene, fingerprints, trace evidence, and submitted it for analysis with the knowledge that in a case this serious and this politically charged for a city watching in horror, the work had to be airtight. The break, when it came, arrived through a combination of old-fashioned investigative work and the kind of paper trail that a man with Paul Dennis Reed's history tended to leave behind. Reed was 34 years old at the time of the Nashville murders, and he was not unknown to law enforcement. He had a prior criminal record in Texas that included a conviction for aggravated robbery, a conviction that had sent him to a Texas prison for years. He had, according to court records and reporting by the Tennessean, relocated to the Nashville area after his release, and he had found work, intermittently, in the fast food industry. That last detail was not incidental. Investigators working the case noted that the perpetrator appeared to have specific, practical knowledge of how these restaurants operated after hours, how the closing routines worked, where the safe was, who would be there, and when. Surveillance footage from the McDonald's on Nolensville Road captured a figure that investigators focused on with increasing confidence. The footage was not, by modern standards, high resolution. This was 1997, and the cameras at these establishments were functional but limited, but it was enough. Enough for investigators to develop a description. Enough, combined with other physical evidence recovered at the scenes, to begin focusing their attention. Fingerprint evidence recovered at one of the crime scenes was submitted for comparison, and according to court records introduced at trial, that evidence connected to Paul Dennis Reed. His prior criminal history meant his fingerprints were in the system. That connection, combined with the surveillance footage and witness accounts from individuals who had seen a man matching Reed's description in the area around the time of the crimes, gave investigators sufficient probable cause to move. Reed was arrested in May of 1997, roughly 3 weeks after the McDonald's murders on Nolensville Road, which is to say, roughly 3 months after the first killings at the Captain D's on Clarksville Pike. He was taken into custody without incident, which was, given what investigators believed they were dealing with, something of a relief. The legal proceedings that followed were by any measure extraordinarily complex. Because the murders had occurred at three separate locations on separate dates, prosecutors had the option, and made the strategic decision, to try Reed separately for each set of killings. This meant that Reed would face multiple trials, each before a different jury, each building its own record of evidence and testimony. The first trial focused on the murders at the Captain D's restaurant. The state's case, as presented by prosecutors from the Davidson County District Attorney's Office, rested on the physical evidence collected at the scene, the surveillance footage, and testimony from witnesses. Prosecutors argued that Reed had entered the restaurant after hours, forced the employees to cooperate under the threat of violence, taken the money from the safe, and then killed both women rather than leave witnesses behind. The defense contested the evidence and challenged the reliability of certain identifications, but after deliberation, the jury found Reed guilty of two counts of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to death. The second trial addressed the murders at the Baskin-Robbins and McDonald's on Old Hickory Boulevard. Here again, prosecutors laid out what they characterized as a pattern. The same methodology, the same targeting of closing-time employees, the same devastating outcome. The jury in that proceeding likewise found Reed guilty, and he received additional death sentences. The third trial covering the murders of the three McDonald's employees on Nolensville Road produced the same result: guilty, death. By the time the proceedings concluded, Paul Dennis Reed had been convicted of seven counts of first-degree murder across three separate trials and had been sentenced to death multiple times over. He sat on Tennessee's death row. But the legal story did not end there. It rarely does in capital cases, and for reasons that went beyond the typical appellate process, Reed's case would occupy the courts for years after his convictions. His attorneys raised a series of challenges on direct appeal, contesting evidentiary rulings, challenging the jury selection process, and arguing various constitutional grounds. The Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals reviewed the convictions and upheld them. The Tennessee Supreme Court likewise affirmed. Petitions moved through the federal courts as well, and at each stage, the convictions were sustained. There was, however, a dimension to the post-conviction proceedings that went beyond the standard appellate checklist. Questions arose over the years regarding Reed's mental competency. Not in the sense of his competency to stand trial at the time of his convictions, which the courts had addressed, but in terms of his ongoing mental state and his competency to be executed. Under the legal standard established by the United States Supreme Court in Ford v. Wainwright, the Eighth Amendment prohibits the execution of a prisoner who does not understand the reason for or the reality of his punishment. Reed's attorneys argued, over the course of extended litigation, that he suffered from serious mental illness that rendered him incompetent under that standard. Courts held hearings. Mental health experts were brought in to evaluate Reed and to testify. The proceedings were drawn out across years. At various points, courts found that the question of his competency required further examination, which had the practical effect of delaying any execution date. As of the most recent documented reporting on the case, Reed remained on Tennessee's death row, his execution having been stayed pending the resolution of competency proceedings, proceedings that had themselves become a lengthy and unresolved chapter of an already long legal saga. He was not exonerated. He was not granted a new trial. His convictions remained intact and affirmed at every level of appellate review. The question before the courts, in the most recent phase of his case, was narrower and more procedural, whether his mental condition at any given moment met the constitutional threshold for execution to proceed. There is something about a case like this that resists easy narration, and it has nothing to do with the facts. The facts in the end were established with considerable thoroughness. The evidence was documented, presented, tested by adversarial process, and found sufficient by multiple juries and multiple appellate courts. What resists narration is something else, the sheer ordinariness of the settings, and what that ordinariness means for the people who died there. Fast food restaurants at closing time are not glamorous places. They are fluorescent and slightly tired, smelling of cooking oil and industrial cleaner. The people who close them are often young, often working to save money for something, school, a car, a future that feels close enough to touch. They are doing what millions of people do every night in every city in this country, and they are doing it without the slightest expectation that anything will go wrong. That is the bargain that ordinary life extends to all of us, and it is a bargain that Ronald Santiago and Jose Gonzalez and Lorraine Hendricks and Sarah Jackson and Andrea Brown and Michelle Mace and Robert Sewell accepted in complete good faith on the nights they went to work. The families of these seven people spent years navigating not only their grief, but also the grinding machinery of a legal process that required them, repeatedly, to return to courtrooms and hear their loved ones' deaths described in the formal, declarative language of criminal proceedings. They did this not once, but several times over. They did it, and then they waited, as the appeals accumulated and the competency hearings were scheduled and the years passed. Whatever justice means in a case like this, and reasonable people can differ on what it means and on whether the death penalty serves it, the families of these victims carried an enormous weight for a very long time. The investigators who worked the case carried something too. The detectives from Metro Nashville, who moved across those three crime scenes in the early months of 1997, who reconstructed what had happened from physical evidence and camera footage in an era before the investigative tools we now take for granted, did work that was careful and consequential. They followed the evidence where it led. The fingerprints, the footage, the record of a man with a violent past who knew these restaurants from the inside, it all pointed in one direction, and they followed it. Paul Dennis Reed was, at the time of this writing, one of the longest-serving inmates on Tennessee's death row, his case having stretched across more than two decades of legal proceedings since his arrests in 1997. His convictions for the murders of seven people were affirmed and have not been overturned. The question of whether he will ultimately be executed remained, as of the most recent documented reporting, unresolved, bound up in the ongoing competency litigation that had become, in its own way, a kind of coda to a case that Nashville had hoped, years ago, to put behind it. There is no clean ending here. The victims' families have lived with an absence that no verdict fills. The courts have worked through the process that the law requires, slowly, methodically, at a pace that can feel to grieving families like something other than justice. And somewhere in that process, the seven people at the center of this story, the ones whose names belong at the front of every sentence about this case, have sometimes been in danger of becoming footnotes to the legal proceedings that followed their deaths. Ronald Santiago, Jose Gonzalez, Lorraine Hendricks, Sarah Jackson, Andrea Brown, Michelle Mace, Robert Sewell. They went to work. They deserved to come home. That is the story, and it is the only story that finally matters. That's three cases for today. From all of us at Intelligix, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.